You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of March 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, hundreds of thousands take to the streets across America and beyond to demand an end to gun violence. But is popular pressure enough? My guests, Somnath Battabiaw and Jane Kinnamont, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Houthi rebels fire seven missiles targeting Riyadh in what seems like retaliation for a similar strike last year. What will this mean for the conflict? Then, Malaysia's government wants to send creators and publishers of fake news to jail. How's that going to work? And in Uzbekistan, the president wants people to tend their gardens and grow produce or face a fine. Could that be exactly what the country needs? That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome indeed to this Monday edition of Midori House. My guests today are Somnath Battabiaw, lecturer in media and development and international journalism at SOAS, and Jane Kinnamont, who's the deputy head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Great to have you both with us. Thanks for coming into Midori House today. And let's start the programme in the United States, where over the weekend, hundreds of thousands, perhaps even millions of people took to the streets to demand gun reform. Over 800 cities globally joined the protests, which started in Washington, D.C. on Saturday. Jane Kinnamont, coming to you first of all, it's been quite interesting to track the tenor of the discussion after the most recent, well, of course, it's not even the most recent, the most recent very grave gun attack in a school in the U.S. A lot of people saying, oh, the debate's shifted this time. Something's different. Is it?
I think there is something about the massive mobilisation of young people that transcends the normal partisan politics. And of course, there are many on the right who are saying this isn't what it seems. You know, there are adults infiltrating this youth-led movement and point to Mayor Bloomberg's donations to it and so forth. But actually, it's been a relatively new voice in the gun debate. The people who are most affected by these attacks on schools calling for their basic safety to be protected. And that is a different way to look at it.
Well, I wonder, Sonath, if you go along with that. And there's certainly been more, I don't know what you'd call it, more potency, better, well, more sort of erudition in the pronouncements that have come from these students who've been affected very, very gravely. And I don't know, are you more struck by that or more struck by the fact that they've outperformed the commentariat or either side in terms of how well they've described their experiences?
You know, I would like to say that, you know, this is a new beginning. People have said, enough, stop. But I honestly don't think that's the case. There's a lot of reasons why recent gun violence is you can organize better, you come out more often, your statements are seen. And that is because of social media, which has many difficult sides. And I'm no advocate of activism on social media, but it does help people connect very quickly. We have seen this for the last 5 to 7 years. And that has really resulted in a resounding kind of impact in viral videos of the shooting going online. World over, people have started to notice there's more coverage and young students talking about their experiences, which world over millions are viewing, does result in this kind of popular mood. But, I mean, you know, there's no way we can say that 15 years earlier, if a shooting like that happened, the local community would not have been outraged. The students would not have been outraged. But perhaps they didn't have the tools for such a kind of mass
to express it
absolutely.
As universally.
But whether this will lead to, and that is the question, changes in law, I'm very sceptical.
Oh, I think I've been expressing my scepticism over the past couple of weeks. And Jane, to that point, what does need to happen if we want to see this popular pressure affect more meaningful change? Because it was interesting that, you know, one of the students very articulately took on Marco Rubio, and he was shown up essentially on live television. And one senses that wouldn't have happened even one political generation ago. And yet, I think that the point that Sonath makes, it's still a huge leap to get legislation to galvanise, you know, the Congress and the rest of it. What could anything do that?
There are two different points I'd like to make here. And one is that the debate over guns needs to be somewhat less polarised in the US, so it's not just about gun ownership or not, but better regulating perhaps certain kinds of weapons that don't necessarily need to be used for recreation or self-defence, trying to get a bit more nuance into that. The second thing is, maybe this won't work. Maybe this is not an administration that is going to listen. Maybe Donald Trump will see a Bloomberg conspiracy everywhere. You know, maybe the lobby groups are too powerful. These things still matter. And I was thinking of it in quite personal terms because, you know, when I was a student at SOAS, I was involved in two protest movements, one against the Iraq war and one much more parochial and local about the introduction of tuition fees into UK universities. In some ways, neither of those succeeded. In other ways, 20 years on, it's now the conventional wisdom here in Britain that the Iraq war was a terrible mistake and also that the tuition-free system has backfired. I find that really interesting. Things do shift in the long term as the people who are of the student protest generation actually become the establishments themselves. Sometimes they move their positions, but also sometimes they change things. And for all the people involved with this, this will be a formative political experience. It will change their views about what is possible for the rest of their lives.
And it's nice to, well, one hopes, be on the right side of history in some of these respects. What about this point, though? And it struck me particularly, Somnath, with what Jane was saying there about the polarity in the political discourse when it comes to guns. Isn't one of the issues here, it's enshrined in the Constitution, and so many Americans, even very intelligent, well-informed ones, can only see that in the black and white of that text. Does this need a constitutional amendment, and could that happen?
To answer your first question, yes. I mean, it's almost religion to own guns in America, and that is one of the problems. And the other thing is, at this point of time, more people want to own guns than are the victims of gun violence. It's just the logic of it, which is a terrible logic, but that's true. They lie low at this point of time, and then they come up very slowly. That's what every time NRA has done. At the point of when an incident like this happens, they go very quietly lobby, and then... whenever, even when President Obama tried to move a few things, nothing happened. And 8 years of presidential rule, who was clearly for gun control, couldn't move a thing.
Well, and he ended up literally weeping with frustration and this feeling that he couldn't affect change. And
I mean, that is one of the things about the American Constitution. Because the Founding Fathers did not want one person or a group to run away with it. There have been so many checks and balances, as should be in any good constitution. This leads to a huge problem, that which the NRA and lobbies like NRA have always exploited. So, yes, a constitutional change needs to happen urgently. I mean, more people get killed by gun violence within the US by random people than any terrorist attack has ever happened anywhere. So, you know, yeah, I mean, it's an obvious yes. What appears strange to the entire world is, how can something so obvious be so difficult? And that's because of the nature of the Constitution.
It might also one day be something for the Supreme Court in terms of interpreting what does that clause mean, the right to bear arms. It's not limitless. I mean, to take it to an absurd example, you don't have the right to have ballistic missiles in your house or chemical weapons. Mm-hmm. So is there some way to put a cap on the kind of arms that are reasonable?
Is the populace able to accept that kind of nuance? Because we see the troubles that the US judiciary has with some fairly routine things, the pressure that comes back on, you know, Roe versus Wade or whatever it might be. Could that happen? I mean, are we looking a couple of generations?
And yet Roe versus Wade has stuck. And it's been interesting that you've seen some US politicians posture about being against it, but in practice they don't have to, because it is a constitutional court decision rather than something that they're expected to legislate on.
But Jane, just talking about when you said ballistic missiles, but even Reagan was against assault weapons. Even he said that, look, no one needs an assault weapon to protect their homes or protect themselves. But it somehow, the most basic, you know, what you're saying seems very apparent. But no American president in the last 60 to 70 years that I can think of has managed any kind of control on the NRA lobby at all. It just, I mean, again, we have, there's been so many arguments, even about the basic checks, which just doesn't seem to work. And I really fail to understand from a distance. And as your friends in the US would say, and academics who come down here, they said they're scared of sending their children to school. And you were just mentioning to me a story about this.
Oh, that's right. A friend of mine whose son's school was closed because they found evidence that someone at the school was planning an attack, which brought home to me that there are more such attacks than you ever, or such plots than you ever hear about. Mm. Unfortunately, sometimes kids are not able to pull them off.
It just struck me, I saw a news story from today about Remington Outdoor, which is I think the most storied and venerable, the oldest US gun maker, which is looking at potential bankruptcy after its 200-year history. And falling demand's been cited by the board. Is this another facet of this which is important? I mean, Jane, let me put this to you. We saw Dick's Sporting Goods, which is a big US sort of hunting and shooting retailer, that rolled back on long guns in the immediate aftermath of this last attack. You know, is it one of these things where corporate pressure can be brought to bear? And it's interesting, we've all mentioned the fact that politicians have been too scared to take on the NRA, but certain US airlines did withdraw their discounts, for example, for the NRA. They did put their money where their mouth was. Could the commercial sector get enough leverage?
I think it's potentially an important route. I was just in the US and saw an advert for an ethical investment fund in a magazine which was advertising, get your money out of guns, invest with us, and it won't go into gun companies. There's the alternative route where activist shareholders do invest in gun companies and then try to use their weight on the board to put more ethical constraints on their business. So yes, I think it's possibly a useful route if the political route continues to be so blocked on this issue.
And so, how optimistic? You mentioned you were a cynic. Is this something where a compelling political narrative from a new young blade, someone who's probably only a tyro politician now, Democrat, well, one presumes Democrat rather than Republican, could force a personality challenge some of these preconceptions, these very entrenched beliefs? Or do you think it will require a more sort of seismic shift along these many sort of strands that Jane's been talking about?
More the latter, because, you know, again, just going back to the Constitution, the way it's designed, one person or a single group, even this large mass population of students, will not be able to engineer a change. But what you just said, you know, corporate pressure from ethical groups, pressure from the government, lawmakers, students. Basically, it has to be a huge mass uprising, which is larger than the gun lobby and gun enthusiasts. If that happens, possibly it is such a seismic shift. So I would really want to say I'm optimistic, but again, just looking at history and context, I fail to say yes, this might be the moment. Yes, you're right. I would want to be an optimist on this. Too many people have died.
Exactly. Well, we always try and relentlessly strike optimistic notes, but when it comes to US gun control, it seems even that it is beyond us. Let's turn our gaze to Saudi Arabia, where at least one person has been killed after 7 missiles were reportedly fired by Houthi rebels from Yemen, targeting the capital at Riyadh. Jane Kinnawant, this isn't the first time this has happened, but I just wonder, is it a pointless act? Is it symbolic? What's the agenda, if these are indeed Houthi rebels who fired these missiles? What are they actually trying to achieve? Because they must appreciate that militarily that's not going to be very effective.
Well, the war in Yemen's been going for around 3 years now and has basically become politically stuck. The Houthis have been, for at least a year, been trying to fire these kinds of missiles into Saudi Arabia, but they have only slowly been really building up their capabilities to do it. They actually tried when Donald Trump was in Riyadh and it didn't hit any targets. But it just seems that they are getting more effective at what they're trying to do. The risks are very, very high, though, because Saudi Arabia entered this war with Yemen because there had been a coup in Yemen post-Arab Spring, and that coup, which was mainly about Yemeni domestic politics, empowered the Houthis, who are friendly with Iran and had at that point some Iranian support. Saudi Arabia looked at this and thought, this is going to turn into Hezbollah on our borders, although that wasn't what was there at the time. They thought this will pose a risk to us. Eventually, they'll be shooting missiles. And this is a classic example of a self-fulfilling prophecy where 3 years into the war, that is exactly what they are facing. Saudi Arabia see Iran's hand behind it, and there is some evidence Iran has been giving the Houthis help here. So one of the worries is that this is something that could really escalate at a time when the Iranian nuclear deal was under very severe strain, and you have a US that's just appointed John Bolton and removed Rex Tillerson and is acting more and more hawkish towards Iran. It seems extremely risky. From the Houthis' point of view, it may simply be lashing out, a sense that we've been bombed for 3 years and we're going to give them a taste of their own medicine. They may think that Saudi Arabia isn't strong and resilient enough to withstand fire and that public support for the war will wither. But of course, they may be very, very wrong about that, because there is a huge anti-Iranian sentiment in Saudi Arabia. To me, it makes it much less likely that Saudi Arabia will agree to the ceasefire that the UN is seeking, which is necessary to try to get peace talks going again.
And I guess this is the point, isn't it, Sonath? I mean, throughout all of that, you're thinking of this sort of proxy players in this, which is, I guess, what this comes down to. And these sorts of incidents, I think it's the first death on Saudi soil since the coalition became involved, possibly at the start of that conflict, as you say, 3 years ago. Now, Jane,
that's right. But there have been Saudis killed in Yemen.
Indeed, yep, indeed. But it's something about on
the war
one's
home.
Own soil which
absolutely.
Brings it home.
Absolutely.
But to that point about, you know, this proxy conflict, I mean, well, it's not even the elephant in the room, it's completely brazen. And as Jane suggests there, it seems more distant than ever that there could be some meaningful dialogue, certainly between any of the actors here.
Yeah. You know, one of the things when we talk about why do the Houthis do the, why are their missiles being fired, it seems a pointless exercise if it's a tactical warfare. I mean, then the question comes is why do the Kashmiris try and attack Indian army? So they're outnumbered, you know, 1,000 to 1, even more. Why do the Palestinians do the same on Israeli soil? In a sense that, as you say, it's a lashing out. I mean, it's the worst humanitarian crisis in the last couple of centuries. 22 million people don't know where the next meal is coming from. 18 million are in starvation situations. What about 15,000 dead, most of them civilians? 5,000, 15,000 injured. I mean, the humanitarian scale of it makes you feel that possibly that, you know, and not that the what has happened in Yemen, you know, the Houthis are not to blame and what they have done. I mean, and again, one of the things Jane and I were talking about before the conversation was, where do you choose to enter this dialogue? Do you enter it in the 1990s when Yemen came together, the North and the South? Do you even go back to the 40s, 50s, the creation of Israel, where so many of the Middle Eastern anger started? You know, do you come in 2011 with the Arab Spring moment? You know, so I always feel that a lot of context is necessary about how to enter this conversation. And I completely agree that, you know, your national geographical integrity, national territories need to be protected. But again, will this be a very heavy-handed response from Saudi Arabia, which since, 2017, the blockade has created a situation where it's one of the world's largest famine situations, which is what the UN is worried about. So, yeah, the response from the Saudi Arabia, will they be, you know, kinder? Will they be diplomatic? I don't know. I mean, Saudi Arabia is not known to be a kind regime.
Indeed. And Jane, to that point, and it's staggering to think about the duration of this already and the kind of numbers that Somnath mentions there. There's a feeling almost the conflict is playing out in a sort of dreadful slow motion. What can the international community do? You mentioned the sort of UN-mandated suggestions, and it seems rather intractable. Is there any way of getting some additional leverage that could actually help the millions and millions of people who are in, you know, really in harm's way in a very stark fashion?
There has to be, I think, greater international pressure for a ceasefire as something that will make talks much more productive. There's a new UN peace envoy this year, Martin Griffiths, which is important because the process had really run out of steam under the last envoy, and this is a chance for a fresh start. But the international community should be going to both Iran and Saudi Arabia and the Houthis, perhaps approaching the Houthis through Oman, and saying that there needs to be an immediate ceasefire. There are countries in Europe now that have stopped selling weapons to Saudi Arabia that could be used in the Yemen war, such as the Netherlands and Norway. Those countries should be approaching Iran and saying, look, we are doing this. We are putting an arms embargo on. But look at your friends, the Houthis. If they are firing missiles into Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia has a legal argument that it is self-defence and it will be easier again for them to get the military technology that they need. This is the time to stop. It might be a card that Iran is actually willing to play, because Iran also needs ways to try to take American pressure off it. And Yemen, it's not a core strategic interest for Iran, so they might be willing to be a helpful actor, although it's also not certain that they have full control over the Houthis.
You're with Midori House, with me, Tom Edwards, Somnath Battibeau and Jane Kinnamont. Stay tuned. Up next, Malaysia wants to crack down on fake news, but is that easier said than done?
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Singapore, Hong Kong and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. My guests today are Somnath Battibeau and Jane Kinnamont. Now, around the world, cities and governments have been trying to figure out how to tackle the emerging threat of fake news. In Malaysia, lawmakers are considering a new bill that would crack down on fake news with a 10-year prison sentence and fines up to $130,000 for people who create or publish such reports. Somnath Battibeau, it's novel. Is it the right approach?
Perhaps not from the Malaysian government. It has a very bad track record when it comes to acquiring powers for itself. In August, I think this year, the Prime Minister Najib Razak is going to get sweeping powers in security matters where he can order his forces on, he can decide what kind of protests can be controlled, he can decide how what size of the army can be deployed on its on civilian population. Also, if you see the past few months, how they have cracked down on opposition lawmakers with the Official Secrets Act, how they have gone after cartoonists and writers. So, you know, the track record is very bad. The elections are coming up, and the one of the main reasons this is being done, of course, is that the Prime Minister is accused of helping friends steal billions, they say, from a state development fund. And this was outed by the foreign media. And of course, you can have cases against the foreign media too. That's part of the law, not that it'll be effective. But also, the I think the environment minister has said that any mention of the funds being embezzled, if not proved, will be seen as fake news. Now, this is an impossible situation. I remember in the 1980s, Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi in India tried a similar stunt. He failed because the entire media protested very strongly. But India had a far more robust democratic situation than Malaysia might at this point of time have. So I'm worried. I don't think the aims and ambitions of this government are correct. Fake news is a phenomenon which will be very difficult. This will be the big elephant in the room for the next decades. A Malaysian government doesn't have the answer to it.
And I guess, Jane, that's the point. You need a sort of holistic approach to this, probably globally. Just on this idea of fake news, though, we bandy the term around so loosely now, and of course it accompanied the rise of Trump, and it continues, and we've had the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal, which kind of adds new layers to it. Are there government-mandated regulatory means of addressing something like this? I rather hope that it's just a sort of a cyclical thing and soon we'll get to a phase where some more robust and proper and thoughtful journalism returns. Do you think we lack a regulatory framework to address fake news, even if it's in defining what it is?
I think the best way to address the problem is through education and media literacy programmes, where people should be taught from a very early age not to believe everything that they read online, even if there's a picture of it, and taught the basics of assessing different sources for bias. Because, of course, there are some things that are just fake news, just untruths. There are many things that where it depends on the eye of the beholder, that someone would see something as a lie that others would see as the truth when it comes to political or social claims. So it is about actually teaching people how to assess it for themselves. I can't see another way that is truly effective, because I think usually when governments do it, it becomes politically convenient for the government to determine what information it wants. There are some instances, you know, in the UK we have Ofcom where there could be complaints if there's a massive misrepresentation or breaches of media ethics, like interviewing people who are maybe prisoners or have been tortured or something like this. We have the Advertising Standards Authority, where if advertisers are making false claims, then cases can be brought against them. So there are some examples here or there. The problem, I think, is too big for regulators, though. It spreads like wildfire. You'll have seen a MIT study last week that says if news is fake, it's 70% more likely to be retweeted.
Well, and to that point, Jonathan, it's interesting to pick up on what Jane was saying there about the pivotal importance of education in this space. I mean, you lecture in media, amongst other things. I just noticed one of the notes that I'd made here as a question to ask you is, are we just doomed? But this is the point, you know. Can we sort of catch up and get back and win? I don't know, what are we talking, kids in primary schools around to looking at things in a more informed way? Is that possible? I don't know.
Tom, I mean, just because you mentioned me being a media scholar of some sort, all news, any news is constructed. So in that larger theoretical sense, all news is fake because any representation is not real. So that is the problem of the medium itself. When you represent something, it is a point of view. Read The Telegraph and The Guardian and you start getting the argument. What is happening at this moment with the coming of the digital age and the ending of the analog, as Salman Rushdie very clearly says, that beautifully says, that it's the final triumph of the numerate over the literate. Mm. So more and more will come.
I've been worrying about that my whole life.
But yes, the moment that, you know, with Facebook and Google, what has happened is this explosion of mediums, which, as Jane was saying, cannot be controlled by any media regulatory authority because they are what we call now the transnational global corporate entities. They're not bound by national governments. Earlier, I'll just give you an Indian example. We have licensing laws, press laws, inadequate perhaps, but you have to perform within this. Facebook doesn't, or Google, or, you know, or we're retweeting or tweet, you know, all these accounts don't have to. So do we have a global framework? So we're kind of talking about, hugely new things. And all that we can at the moment are asking of organizations like Facebook or Twitter is self-regulation, you know. And when it comes to profit, self-regulation always takes a backseat.
Indeed. Well, let's move on because we're short of time. And I did want to ask you both about what we're hearing from Uzbekistan. Citizens have been warned to use their gardens efficiently or face triple land tax. Triple land tax, Jane. Three words designed to strike fear into the heart of any man or woman. They're going to monitor households and make sure that they're doing things right. They basically want to see a small holding in every back garden. Is there something to this? Apparently the president acts by doing. He owns more than 100 chickens. Does he have a point?
Well, I only read a little about this before the show and I was interested to see apparently 80% of private sector agricultural production in Uzbekistan is through these small holdings, kitchen gardens of various sizes. And the other thing that quickly comes up is that they are complaining that they don't have enough access to water. So one wonders whether the government may be trying to shift the blame somewhat.
And again, it wouldn't be the first time we've probably returned to that theme in this programme. Is this something that's politically expedient for the current incumbent to say at the moment? And actually, it's going to be much more costly and much more difficult to actually deliver on those things for the bulk of the population.
Yes, again, I mean, I do not, again, I wouldn't, not being a farmer myself, not doing any kind of gardening in my entire life, being a city boy, I wouldn't, I think, the gesture from the president and what he's saying and how he sees himself, it's nice and kind and entertaining, and it's a nice way to end this program, which has been terrible stories all through. But again, whenever it is top-down things like this, as a small holdings conversation, you find it difficult to have traction.
Indeed. Just one of the difficulties we've wrestled with on today's programme. And thanks to both my guests for trying their level best. Thanks to Somnath Battabiel and to Jane Kinnamont, both for joining us on the programme. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Pierre-Antoine Denis, and our studio manager was David Stevens. My thanks to them. We've got some more music for you. Robert Bound will bring you Culture at the top of the hour, 1900 here in London. And we'll have more on all the main stories of the day on the Monocle Daily. That is from 2200 London time. This show is back at the same time tomorrow with yours truly in the chair. Do join me, if you will, at 1800 London time. But from me, Tom Edwards, and all the Monday team here at Midori House, thank you very much for tuning in.